I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. This today we talk about the management of acute myeloid leukemia with Dr. Andrew Way from the Alfred Hospital and Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. We have a great faculty for this series. Today we're here to talk about AML and the amazing developments that have occurred, particularly in the last few years. As always, we have some docs who are going to be presenting cases to Dr. Way as we kind of make rounds today on this interesting topic. Here's one of the slides you can check out. There are a lot more in the slide deck, as well as a bunch of data slides for you to consider. This is from the survey we did from the investigators. But I want to start out today and talk a little bit about an area that Dr. Way's really had a major leadership role, which is really understanding the biology of this disease and particularly the pharmacology, particularly as it relates to some of these new agents. I'll just tell you, for you to check out in the, again, slide set, here are some of the great review articles Dr. Way's done recently looking at these issues, some really cool graphics here. I want to talk today, not really look at slides. This other paper where he gets into venetoclax and, again, some of the data from some of the HMA and RC papers. But Andrew, just to take a deep breath, it's been amazing what's happened the last few years. Can you kind of talk a little bit about your vision for some of the new biology considerations that have come out as we learn more about the disease, and particularly what we've learned about the mechanism of action of all these novel agents that have come into the field, IDH inhibitors, FLT3, of course, venetoclax. Can you comment?
So I think things have changed a lot in the last few years. We still have three basic principles of therapy, however. The first job is to get patients into remission, because we know if we don't do that, then patients will often succumb to complicated infections and possibly bleeding. The second objective is, once we get patients into remission, how do we keep them there? And then the third objective is that, unfortunately, some patients will fail our primary therapies and have relapsed and resistant disease. And then obviously we need to try and address that really difficult situation. So with respect to the getting people into remission objective, we usually break people down into two groups, those that are fit or unfit for intensive chemotherapy. And probably the two major advances in the last 5 years in that area are, firstly, the utilization of FLT3 inhibitors for fit people requiring intensive chemotherapy with midostaurin, and second, with the introduction of venetoclax targeting BCL2 in combination with azacitidine or, to a lesser extent, low-dose RSC, to get people with AML unfit for intensive chemotherapy into remission. So with both of those approaches, we can now get approximately 80% of people into remission, which is a really excellent starting point. The second major advance is keeping people in remission, and we now have oral AZA as a maintenance therapy that can try and keep people in remission for longer, particularly those people who are not suitable for a transplant. And in the relapse and refractory setting, we have some targeted therapies which have become very commonly used, particularly gilteritinib for FLT3 mutant disease, which has progressed, and also IDH mutation situations where, again, targeted therapies are available. And there are some new presentations at ASH this year, which also shed some light on the use of those targeted therapies in the frontline unfit setting.
When you think about some of the agents that are new to the field, what's your vision in terms of mechanism of action, starting with venetoclax? I've heard Dan Pollier talks about his thought about this related to stem cells. What's your vision about how venetoclax works? And I've heard it described as, sort of like a rituximab of AML. Is that kind of your vision? Do you think eventually it's going to work its way into almost all patients' therapy?
The beauty of targeting BCL2, and that's been a real pharmacologic triumph in terms of, it's the first drug which can actually interfere with the interaction of two proteins as opposed to binding a kinase pocket. Furthermore, each cell, normal and leukemic, have five pro-survival proteins. And in a sense, you can almost consider each of those pro-survival molecules as a self-destruct button. And different cancers, including leukemia, will have a certain dependency on one of these self-destruct buttons that will make them sensitive to a specific inhibitor of that pro-survival molecule. It just so happens that for AML, targeting BCL2 is an important component in causing apoptosis of those cells. But we also realize that we have to combine venetoclax with another therapy in order to help kill the broader spectrum of leukemias, because we just know that there's so many different mutations and combinations that are possible. So, for instance, in really large genomic surveys done by Eli Papamanual, if I asked you the question, how many of those hundreds and sometimes thousands of patients were exactly identical in terms of their molecular components? In fact, the answer is 2. So that just shows you the diverse heterogeneity which each patient has. And that's why I think broader therapies to get patients into remission are really important, but also utilizing targeted therapies to try and deal with problems where chemotherapy or low-intensity therapies on their own are insufficient.
You were talking about your vision of how venetoclax works and that the whole apoptotic pathway. Where does magrolimab fit in?
Magrolimab is a fascinating therapy which has really developed very quickly in the last few years, and it sort of came through the work done in the west coast of the US. And basically, it's a drug which is an antibody, and it targets CD47. And CD47 happens to be a really important signal which cells use to tell other cells to don't eat them. And so when you block that, basically it triggers a macrophage process whereby engulfment can occur. And the beauty of that is that it now allows us to utilize a therapy to target a broad range of leukemic biologies, including biologies which are conventionally resistant to therapies such as P53 mutant AML. And perhaps the most exciting possibility is that magrolimab in combination with azacitidine or azacitidine plus venetoclax, I think could have great potential to help to overcome one of the most difficult to treat subgroups of AML, which has really eluded effective therapy for decades now.
So how about if I throw in glazedajib?
Yes, glazedajib is a drug which is targeting hedgehog, and it was shown to be positive in a randomized trial by Jorge Cortes when compared to low-dose Ara-C. The response rate, however, is modest, more in the range of 20 to 30% rather than 60 to 70%, which is what we see when we use venetoclax in combination with azacitidine. So I think at this stage, ven plus low-dose chemotherapy is the preferred option because of the rapidity of the response, the higher level of the response, and also the longer duration of survival, particularly with azacitidine. There is a randomized study of glazedajib in combination with azacitidine, which hasn't read out yet. And so it'll be interesting when that study comes through.
Have you actually used the drug? And what do you see in terms of tolerability? You know, we hear from, in a basal cell, taste problems, et cetera, not very good things. How about glazedajib?
Yeah, so unfortunately, most of the new therapies generally have some chink in their armor with respect to tolerability. There's no such thing as a perfect drug which works without any modest liability. And in the case of glazedajib, dysgeusia or abnormal taste is one of the concerns which a proportion of patients report. And so obviously with venetoclax, myelosuppression is a prominent feature. And so it really just tells us that not just the response is important, but how to manage tolerability to the drugs and to how to prevent some of the complications is a really important component of holistic care.
So we're going to jump into the cases in a second, but one more sort of introductory thought I wanted to get your thoughts on. We're hearing a lot about MRD and so many different cancers now, and solid tumors. We're talking about circulating DNA. What are your thoughts in terms of MRD assays and AML moving forward?
Yeah, MRD is going to be an increasingly important component of our routine management in the future. We now have emerging technologies, including highly sensitive qPCR assays, which can very sensitively monitor NPM1 MRD to a level of 10 to the minus 6. Obviously, we've been doing this for years for APL and also core binding factor leukemias, but there are other fusions such as MLL fusions, which can be monitored again with very high sensitivity. And this is important because there are new therapies which can target MLL fusions, such as the menin inhibitors. IDH mutations can also be tracked very sensitively with digital PCR. However, we have to be careful that the MRD that we're trying to measure is not actually a pre-leukemic biology. And so understanding the limitations of these technologies are very important. However, the concept which I would like to put out there is that often we've used MRD as measuring the response to treatment. But think of the possibilities of using MRD as part of your patient's surveillance, that is monitoring patients in remission. And then if you see a rising MRD, which the European Leukemia Net recommendations would suggest, if there's a one log increase, almost all of these patients will eventually relapse within the next few months clinically. And then imagine the possibility of MRD-directed therapy. So for instance, rising NPM1, target that MRD before the patient relapses. Rising MLL disease, target that with a menin inhibitor before the patient relapses. And also targeting FLT3 ITD. There are NGS-based assays which can now detect, you know, one in a million particles or cells which are positive. Can you target that with a FLT3 inhibitor or combinations before the patients had gross relapse? I think this will be the future, because patients treated in that manner are going to be treated in a much healthier state with normal blood counts. Concomitant drug-drug interactions are going to be eliminated. And also many of these patients can be treated as outpatients rather than putting them into hospital and giving them multi-agent myelosuppressive therapies. And those patients can still be taken to transplant, but in a much fitter state of being and with a much higher rate of MRD responses potentially. So I think this is going to be a big part of our future in AML.
The last time we did a webinar, somebody in the chat room, we were talking about a real controversial case, and somebody in the chat room goes, I want to know what you would do today. I think it was like January 16th, 2021. And I'm looking at him going, it's not January 16th, it's January 15th. And then I realize you all are living in the future. You're in tomorrow already, right?
That's right. Just a little bit. We'll take advantage of that.
Right. Really amazing how things work nowadays. All right, let's jump into some cases. Speaking about virtual, these are some communications from the real world, so to speak. We're going to start out with Dr. Khan, who's a general medical oncologist. And like all these docs, I sit down with them for an hour, hour and a half. They present bladder cancer, breast cancer, myeloma, and you know, every single one of them, they've got to be cutting edge. So, AML was sort of outside the realm of the GMOs, general medical oncologists, the last few years when all kinds of alternatives started to develop, fortunately. In any event, this is a 75-year-old man, actual multiple serious comorbidities, particularly cardiovascular, presents with pancytopenia, put on Ven-Aza, nothing particularly unusual, but it was kind of interesting because he didn't know that he was going to end up on your program, but he had a whole bunch of questions about low-dose IRC, so I thought we could start out with that. Here's Dr. Khan.
75-year-old gentleman who is known to have multiple comorbidities, including EF less than 40%, previous history of congestive heart failure, GFR around 30, was diagnosed with acute myelogenous leukemia, but he did not have leukocytosis. He in fact presented with pancytopenia. He is on now full dose of venetoclax, 400 milligram, and he is getting 5-day regimen of azacitidine. It is still premature to see whether he is responding. Venetoclax has been studied with low dose ARA-C. I don't think we are using that much in the United States. Is there any role for using cytarabine, low-dose cytarabine with venetoclax? Are there any subset of patients who do better with that regimen? What is the most convenient way to use low-dose ARA-C with venetoclax?
So, you know, rather than sort of go through all the slides that everybody else goes through, which we have in our slide deck if people want to look at it, I just want to hear from you, from your point of view, kind of how the VIALE-A and VIALE-C trials evolved, what the thinking was at that time, and basically what we know in terms of the data and clinical implications of those studies. And in particular, his question about low-dose IRC, which, of course, VIALE-C is the trial that you ran. Can you kind of, and also, you know, just to keep in mind, the last couple of months, we've been thinking a lot about millennial physicians who maybe have only been in oncology, you know, 5 or 10 years and don't realize what AML was like maybe 5 years ago. So maybe you can just kind of reflect on this incredible story of these two trials.
Sure, Neil. So when these trials first developed, we were in a situation back in 2014 where really low-dose ARA-C or hypermethylating agents were all we had available for older people with AML unfit for intensive chemotherapy. Low-dose ARA-C gave us responses of barely 20% and hypermethylating agents responses on the order of 28%. And when venetoclax as a single agent was developed, its response rate was only 19% with short duration. And it was actually unclear whether that was going to become an important drug or not. So the logical thing that we did in those days was we combined it with conventional therapies used for older people. And so that led to the combination with low-dose ARA-C or with hypermethylating agents, because at that stage, the world was quite divergent in whether it had access to azacitidine or not. And so some parts of the world had to use low-dose ARA-C. And so the thinking was, let's do the combinations, both of them, so we would make a universally applicable treatment option. Fortunately, both of those combinations were found to be successful in terms of increasing responses in the phase 1b trials, and that led to the pivotal VIALE-C for ARA-C and VIALE-A for azacitidine randomized trials, which everyone knows the results now, they were positive. And so that was the evolution of those two therapies. So the question now is, if you had access to both of those options, is there a situation where you would not use Ven/Aza, which was the question from Dr. Khan? Because I've had access to both therapies since 2014, I've been able to use both, which gives me perhaps a slightly unique insight into the applicability of the two treatment options. There are certain patients that I would consider still using low-dose ARA-C venetoclax. Firstly, there are some patients that really find it difficult to get to the day center to have azacitidine-based treatment for 7 days each month. And for those patients, we can send out a nurse to their home and to give them a dose of low-dose ARA-C once a day for 10 days, and they find that more convenient. Second, there are some patients whose renal function, Dr. Khan mentioned this patient already had a borderline renal function, but there are some patients when you give them azacitidine, their renal function deteriorates quite clearly. And so in that situation, using AZA becomes a problem. And so in that setting, low-dose ARA-C we find to be very safe and appropriate for patients with very severe renal impairment. The third situation is that if we compare the two studies, the response rate for Ven/Aza for patients with NPM1 mutant AML was 67%. With low-dose ARA-C Ven, it was 79%. And in our experience, the NPM1 MRD eradication rate with low-dose ARA-C Ven is extremely high. And so I find that a very well-tolerated, easy-to-use, highly effective treatment for that particular subgroup of patients.
The other subgroup that I've heard people talk about low-dose ARA-C is the patients who are getting hypomethylating agents for MDS and then develop AML. What do you do in that situation? Do you add in venetoclax or change the HMA or maybe use venetoclax ARA-C? What do you do in that situation?
So in the VIALE-C trial, there were about 20% of patients that had prior HMA exposure, and the response there was just under 40%. There was a small study done, which was led by Amir Zidane and presented at ASH a couple of years ago, which looked at patients with HMA failure and using either Ven alone or Ven in combination with AZA. The Ven alone didn't really have any responses, but the Ven/Aza after HMA failure produce responses in about 40% of patients. And so I think the summary is that the response rates to either low-dose ARA-C or HMA-Ven in HMA failure is sort of similar, and either could be utilized at this stage. My personal preference is perhaps to lean towards using Ven/Aza at this stage and then trying to get patients who are fit enough to a transplant, because ultimately that's the only curative pathway that we know at the moment.
So I'm going to go back to our docs, and one of the things I do is give them the opportunity to query investigators. So I want to show you some of the many questions that we get, particularly about the use of Ven in AML. Here are some questions from Dr. Rebecca Olin.
I think venetoclax is really exciting, and I almost want to say that it's analogous to the Rituxan of lymphoma. I think it's going to make potentially almost anything work better when combined with venetoclax. 7+3 plus venetoclax, FLAG IDA venetoclax from MD Anderson that's got some really interesting data. And I'm curious to know if they're using any of this in practice yet, or if there's anything they think they're particularly excited about for the future. One challenge for venetoclax, I think, is that it is pretty myelosuppressive. And I think we need to work out what the right dose and schedule is with all of these different regimens. And it may be that we need less than we think in order to achieve the best response. For the oral hypomethylating agents, it would be wonderful, I think, to be able to prescribe all oral therapy for these patients. I am curious whether people are doing this off-label or if they're waiting for more data to be available from trials. My own stance is I'm sort of waiting for the data to be available, but I'm looking forward to it.
So, you know, when she kind of surprised me with that idea about the rituximab of AML, I'd heard daratumumab being called the rituximab of myeloma. But what are your thoughts about that? Do you see eventually venetoclax? And of course, obviously the issue of tolerability and particularly cytopenias. But do you see moving forward that we're going to land, you know, 3 to 5 years from now with almost all patients getting venetoclax?
I think there is a definite possibility of its extension into many areas of AML practice because it is a drug which can synergize with so many different pathways. And already we're seeing in early phase studies, venetoclax in combination with FLT3, IDH inhibitors, now with immunotherapies, maintenance therapy now in combination with oral AZA, obviously frontline therapy in combination with oral drugs, and then intensive therapy and also relapse refractory disease in combination with intensive options. So there's almost no limit to the potential use of venetoclax. And for that reason, I think it's now left to investigators almost imagination as to how far we can go. But certainly its applicability, I think, is going to have an incredibly broad impact on almost all areas of AML in the future.
What about her thought or question about, you know, first of all, I don't know how much there is a relationship between in AML between dose and cytopenias, but what about the issue of sort of minimal dose that you want to see of venetoclax, at least theoretically? And do you think that maybe moving forward, again, particularly in the intensive combinations, that we could use a lower dose?
Yeah, it's a really important question. And it comes down to what is the optimal therapeutic window for this drug? So what I can tell you is that from our phase one studies, we actually escalated ven in combination with AZA up to 1200 milligrams. But we found that at 800 milligrams of ven, patients got into remission okay, but the ability to tolerate recurrent cycles was problematic because of cumulative myelosuppression. And so that's how we landed with the 400 milligram dose. In terms of is there a lower dose level, there's not much been done on that. However, in the intensive chemotherapy combinations that Dr. Olam mentioned, FLAG IDA and also 7+3, a dose of 200 milligrams is sort of chosen, obviously because of trying to mitigate the risk of toxicity. We actually did an interesting study, which we published in JCO a couple of years ago, called the CAVEAT study, where we actually gave venetoclax in combination with 5+2 intensive chemotherapy. And we actually went through systematically a variety of doses ranging from 50 milligrams per day through to 600 milligrams per day, but also included 100, 200, 400. And we actually found when we look at the responses, there was a dose response relationship where the plateaus of responses sort of occurred at 200 milligrams and above. So that tells us that I think you need to use at least 200 milligrams of ven to get optimal response, and that above 400 to 600, we're going to start getting into myelotoxicity, as I mentioned before. So that's sort of the therapeutic window from my experience.
Any comment on non-hematologic toxicity of venetoclax? I feel like I've heard a couple of cases with GI issues, but what do you generally see?
Yeah, so at the moment, if a patient is not on azoles or a CYP3A4 inhibitor, they're going to take between 4 to 6 tablets of venetoclax per day. And so nausea is one of the commonly reported problems. Sometimes patients just report fatigue, and it's hard to explain because they're in remission. They seem to be doing well, but they'll just tell you they feel rather fatigued. And in the early setting, from my point of view, it's not very common. It happens in about 4% of patients, but it is really critical, is the issue of tumor lysis syndrome. Although if you only use venetoclax from time to time, you won't see it very often. However, if you use enough, you will see this, as I mentioned, in about 1 in 20 and 1 in 25 patients. And the importance of that is that just with the first dose of venetoclax, say 100 milligrams with azacitidine, within 4 to 6 hours, the potassium could be 7 or 8, which when I tell you that is obviously very quite alarming. And so we have to really watch these patients, do that 4 to 6 hour electrolyte level, especially if we're doing this in the outpatient setting, we're thinking about sending the patient home. We need to check that before we send them home, just to make sure they're not one of these patients that has this problem, because it's not always going to be patients with a high white cell count which can have this problem. Even a patient with a high bone marrow blast burden above 50% will have it. And patients that have NPM1 or IDH1 or 2 mutations also seem to be highly predisposed to this issue.
I have a couple other questions. This is Dr. John Yang. And you know, Andrew, I've been doing audio production for a long time. We started that way before the virtual world. Dr. Yang, who I call the voice, he's very, you know, modest about this. He has the best voice I think I've ever heard in my audio history. In any event, here's Dr. Yang's question about HMA venetoclax.
One of the challenges when we use venetoclax with azacitidine or decitabine is that the patients would become very cytopenic. And I struggled with, if I were to give them less venetoclax, would it compromise the efficacy of the treatment? Would dose reductions be beneficial toward their cytopenias? Now, my experience seemed to be, even with dose reductions, these patients continued to have severe cytopenias. I think most patients do respond to it.
This, of course, is the number one question you hear from all oncologists: cytopenias. You know, of course, not just AML. Venetoclax is used very, very frequently in CLL, myeloma, et cetera. Any comments on his questions about the cytopenias?
Yes, it's one of the most difficult, but also one of the most important practice questions that we face. The way I address this is to give people a set of principles. The first principle is prevention, so trying to prevent the problem in the first place. We can do that by firstly taking a bone marrow assessment around day 21, and if the patient has cleared their bone marrow blast, then stop the venetoclax. That's the first principle. The second principle is don't use too much venetoclax. And so the issue there is that when you use CYP3A4 inhibitors like posaconazole, the question is, what is the optimal dose of venetoclax to give response, but without giving toxicity? Many people have different answers to this: 100 milligrams, 70 milligrams, 50 milligrams. In the VIALE A and C trials, when we did use posaconazole, we reduced the dose of venetoclax to 50 milligrams. And so if you want an evidence-based answer on how to reproduce the trial results, the answer is 50 milligrams. With respect to what to do if the patient has cleared their blasts and they're taking a long time to recover their bone marrow counts, G-CSF can obviously be used. And the other principle I'd like to put across is don't start the second cycle after achieving response too quickly. Some people, they get response on day 21 and they start the next cycle straight away. My advice is give the patient time to recover their blood counts to a minimum of CRH or even to CR. This could be up to 2 weeks of a break. Give the patient some time at home. This will be really beneficial to helping them tolerate the subsequent cycle of therapy. If despite all of that, the patient still continues to be cytopenic, the third principle is understand what is going on. So if you do a bone marrow assessment and the patient has an empty bone marrow, then one of the considerations could be not only to reduce the duration of venetoclax from, say, 28 to 21 or to 14 days, but also to reduce the dose of azacitidine from 75 milligram per meter squared to 50 or even down to 37.5, depending on tolerability and response. Furthermore, if the bone marrow shows that the patient has persistent disease as the cause of cytopenia, then consider what else could be done. Is there another targetable option? If the patient has really poor risk disease like P53 mutant pathology, should the patient actually go to transplant before they progress? And third, there's a scenario of the patient doesn't have an empty bone marrow, they haven't got persistent disease, but they have a lot of cells there and they're dysplastic. And so dysplastic pathology, which may not be responsive to ven-based therapy, is another option. And in that setting, using less cycles of therapy may be the answer. That is, not giving a cycle every month, but maybe waiting 2, 3, sometimes even 4 months, watching the bone marrow. If they haven't progressed, but they've still got low blood counts, there's no point in giving another cycle of therapy. Just wait. And in sometimes they may have low blast progression, say 4 or 5 months later, then give a cycle of therapy to move the blast back down into remission status. So there is a lot of tailoring, but I just wanted to highlight those three major principles that hopefully will guide some of your listeners in using Ven and Aza optimally.
When you are going to do a dose reduction, how do you decide whether it's going to be the HMA, venetoclax, or both?
Generally, if the patient just has a delayed recovery but doesn't have a hypoplastic bone marrow, then normally we would reduce the Ven duration from 28 to 21 to 14 days. I rarely reduce the actual dose of Ven from 400 downwards unless I've got down to like 7 days of Ven and I'm still having problems. Then I'll reduce it to 200 milligrams for those seven days. The other scenario is if you're using, say, 100 milligrams of Ven with posaconazole, that's equivalent to possibly 800 milligrams of Ven. And so reducing the Ven dose in that setting to down to 50 milligrams could be, in fact, the best treatment approach.
So we have another case here. This is a patient of Dr. Prashant Sharma, a 67-year-old woman with a FLT ITD mutation. She was treated with 7 plus 3 with midostaurin, consolidation, high-dose IRC and midostaurin, multiple complications, ICU admissions, sepsis, viremia. The patient ended up declining further intensive therapy, including transplant. The marrow was EOT. The patient was put on gilteritinib, required a dose reduction, but then relapsed and was put on Ven azacitidine, is now responding to that. And Dr. Sharma's question is kind of looking back on the case, you know, sort of second guessing or questioning what was done here. Should he have used CC486 as maintenance or maybe even the combination? Here's Dr. Sharma.
She had induction with 7+3 and midostaurin, landed up in the ICU with sepsis. She did not want to go through transplant or further chemotherapy. So we did a kind of end of treatment bone marrow biopsy, which was negative based on morphology as well as flow. She received 7 months of therapy with 80 milligrams of gilteritinib and her count started dropping and she had relapsed. She was started on azacitidine and venetoclax, which she continues. She has some cytopenias, but she remains in CR. My question would be, would you have done anything differently? CC486 or oral azacitidine was approved for maintenance in patients who underwent induction chemotherapy followed by incomplete consolidation as a maintenance, and we have used it for that indication. You know, when it first came, there was a lot of excitement. There's still excitement, and I think it's a good drug, but we didn't realize that it can cause so much of cytopenias and GI side effects in some patients. I wonder how the experts would manage the GI side effect as well as cytopenias.
So any comments?
Yeah, again, a really important case. Let me start with the FLT3 situation in a patient over the age of 60. It's always easy with the retrospectoscope to say, look, in hindsight, maybe we should have used less intensive approaches. However, there is still strong data. At this year's ASH, Hartmut Döhner is going to present the German data showing that 7 and 3 with midostaurin in people between the ages of 60 and 70, that those patients have a very good outcome if they have FLT3 mutant AML. However, if the patient does progress later, the question is what to do in that setting, and Dr. Sharma used Ven-Aza. Ven-Aza is appropriate in that setting. One thing to realize, I think he used gilteritinib actually. The first thing I just want to point out is that after patients receive midostaurin in the frontline setting, if you look at the relapses, in fact, 40% of patients will lose the FLT3 mutation. And so I think the first important point is to re-molecularly characterize the patient to see if that FLT3 ITD or TKD is still there. If that is the case, then yes, gilteritinib is the appropriate line of therapy. In terms of would I have done anything differently in the frontline setting, At the moment, we do have Venaza as an option that produces responses on the order of 75% in people who are FLT3 mutant positive. However, when we look at the subgroup analyses, those with ITD don't seem to have an improved survival benefit above azacitidine alone. TKD, the benefit still seems to be there. So the message is, if you do use Venaza in the frontline setting for FLT3 mutant patients, if the patients progress, then emergence of FLT3 ITD is potentially a problem. And again, recharacterize the patient and consider a gilteritinib.
You did the QUASAR study looking at CC486, oral azacitidine. Can you talk about that study, sort of what the background was in terms of why it was done, what the results show, and what you see as the clinical implication? He was wondering whether he should have considered using that in this patient earlier on.
So oral azacitidine was used on the back of the development of the drug and obviously trying to find its optimal place in terms of a hypomethylating agent that was easier to administer and more convenient for patients. So the dose finding studies found that 300 milligrams for 14 days was the best balance between myelosuppression as well as tolerability. In terms of tolerability, when we did the trial, it was a placebo-controlled maintenance study, and therefore we didn't know which arm the patients were on, and so prophylactic antiemetics were not used. And so that's why the GI toxicity rate is 50%. If, however, you look at what happens after the initial therapy, that is cycles two and onwards, you can see that the GI toxicity rate went down substantially. And that's because we used prophylactic antiemetics. So if your patients do have nausea or vomiting, it's absolutely imperative to give them an antiemetic each day of the oral azacitidine, which could be 14 days of therapy. The other question is the myelotoxicity. Although the myelotoxicity rate was reported to be on the order of 30 to 40% with respect to neutropenia, only about 17% of patients actually needed G-CSF support. So in fact, the high-level neutropenia was actually quite uncommon, and severe thrombocytopenia was also uncommon. So at that dose level, it is quite well tolerated. When people have maintenance therapy and there's a slight excess of blasts between 5 to 15% in the QUASAR study, we did allow an extension of therapy to 21 days of oral azacitidine. That did lead to a higher frequency of febrile neutropenic complications because of cytopenia. So that, I think, is illustrating that 2 weeks is about the right level of therapy to use.
Can you describe a clinical situation where you would use that strategy?
In terms of the 21-day strategy or the
14-day? No, I'm just talking about using the drug, yes, oral AZA in general.
It's absolutely intriguing to think of the possibilities of oral AZA and the convenience of that therapy for frontline patients, for elderly patients in particular, and also oral AZA in combination with many of these new therapies which are coming through, like gilteritinib for relapsed refractory disease, IDH for the same. What we don't know yet is what's the right conversion from oral AZA into parenteral AZA, either subcut or IV, because the bioavailability is quite different. So we can't just, unfortunately, convert an oral AZA dose into the same subcut AZA dose and expect to get the same results. The only treatment where that has been done so far is with oral decitabine, where the drug was found to actually be bioequivalent to decitabine. So in that setting, we could theoretically use oral decitabine at a 5-day schedule in combination with venetoclax, because that's equivalent to IV decitabine, which we have done and shown to be efficacious and tolerable. However, it's not technically an approved indication at the moment.
I do hear people talking about that, though. Getting back to maintenance therapy with oral azacitidine, can you describe a clinical situation? Would you have considered it in this patient, for example? Mm. In patients who sort of bail out on the intensive approach in the middle.
So at this stage, oral AZA can be utilized in patients with maintenance as maintenance therapy. However, the more, I think, common approach in a patient that's FLT3 mutant is to use midostaurin as maintenance therapy, even though the trials weren't powered to actually show that that specific component of therapy was clearly advantageous. What I would like to consider, though, is that some patients, even in their late 60s, might still be candidates for reduced intensity stem cell transplant. And so still, I feel that if a patient can go to transplant with a FLT3 mutant pathology, that is still an important consideration. The other thing which is new at the moment is to actually track FLT3 ITD. That can be done, as I mentioned before, with ultra-high sensitivity using NGS. And the really intriguing possibility is that rather than giving maintenance therapy, you can track patients. And when you see the MRD rising, the consideration perhaps in the future to then use a FLT3 targeted approach in that setting, I think has intriguing possibilities. Some of my colleagues have reported to me that using gilteritinib in the rising FLT3 MRD setting to be highly efficacious. And you can also consider the possibility of using gilteritinib in combination with venetoclax as being potentially even more effective in that rising MRD setting. And that's going to be the subject of a new trial we're going to start in the new year.
So in terms of FLT3 disease, in terms of its current management, there are a lot of questions about older patients who are not eligible for intensive therapy. We saw a press release from the so-called LACEWING study that's finally going to be presented at the ASH meeting. Maybe you can comment on that and other strategies, HMA venetoclax / FLT3, bringing in gilteritinib. Where do you see things heading in terms of the older patient FLT3?
Yes, the older patient group with FLT3 remains a key component, and there are three different approaches which people are looking at. First of all is obviously ven-aza, because that's available at the moment. As I mentioned before, responses are high, but relapses are common. And then you would have to consider the strategy of using a FLT3 inhibitor at the time of progression. The second option is to use gilteritinib upfront in combination with AZA. And that was the subject of the LACEWING study, which Eunice Wang will present at ASH this year. In that trial, 123 patients were allocated in a 2-to-1 manner to gilteritinib AZA or to AZA alone. And unfortunately, the primary endpoint of that study, which was overall survival, was not in favor of the combination, being about 9 to 10 months in both arms. The gilteritinib did produce higher responses, around 50% compared to 30%. And there was a subgroup analysis which showed survival benefit in patients with high FLT3 allelic ratio above 0.5. However, the primary endpoint would suggest that gilteritinib in the frontline setting is perhaps not going to be utilized. The third approach is to combine ven-aza with gilteritinib in the frontline setting. And so that's the subject of other research which is being done by investigators. And so the issue there is potentially myelotoxicity, and trying to find the right schedule of a triplet approach still remains the key research question.
So a quick question from Syed in the chat room, who has an elderly patient who's in CR with AML on parental HMA venetoclax. Now it's a year and a half later, the patient's doing well, wants to know about oral AZA plus VEN. You just commented on the problems of using oral AZA. First of all, what about switching the patient to decitabine, as you mentioned, oral decitabine? And any situations where you'd ever hold therapy and just observe the patient?
So with the QUASAR study, oral AZA was tolerated by the majority. There were only a small proportion of patients that had to stop therapy because of toxicity issues. And so the median number of cycles in that trial was 12 cycles of oral AZA. And after, in fact, 2 years of oral AZA maintenance, one third of patients were still taking therapy. And I even had some patients who were taking oral AZA for over 5 years. Whether we can switch from a parenteral AZA to oral AZA, it's at the moment hypothetical. It's clearly possible, and clearly would be more convenient for the patient to not have to come into the day center. So that's certainly a possibility. In terms of oral decitabine, at this stage, that therapy hasn't been validated in the maintenance setting.
What about just a straightforward, treatment of an older patient to begin with?
So that's another frontier in terms of using oral AZA perhaps in combination with venetoclax as frontline therapy. And that's actually the subject of a trial called Omniverse, which is currently underway. There are no publications on that topic at the moment, but the key question is finding the right dose of oral laser, the right duration on which to use it for, in combination with, say, Ven, to give us the responses that hopefully will be similar to what we've had with Ven with a subcutaneous or IV AZA. Until we have that information, I think taking chances with a patient with all of those uncertainties which I've mentioned, perhaps we're not quite ready for that just yet.
All right, so let's go on to another case. This is a patient of Dr. Priya Rudolph, a 72-year-old man with AML and an IDH1 mutation. Here's Dr. Rudolph.
72-year-old patient who is in excellent health. He builds ramps for handicapped folks actively with his church. He was diagnosed with polycythemia vera back in November 2017. In November 2020, did a bone marrow biopsy, and surprisingly enough, he had 70 to 80% myeloblasts consistent with the diagnosis of acute myelogenous leukemia. Given his IDH1 mutation status, would you incorporate IDH1 inhibitor avacitinib in his therapy upfront? I usually transfer these patients over to our transplant center, and they started him on daunorubicin and cytarabine. Unfortunately, after the first cycle, he still had persistent blasts. So he was just recently reinduced with decitabine and venetoclax, and their plan is to take him to a reduced intensity allotransplant. Would you treat him with CPX351? Would you give him 7+3? Would you give decitabine or azacitidine and venetoclax? I would like to know how they decide how to treat somebody that's de novo versus with an underlying myeloproliferative disorder.
And also where IDH inhibition fits in a case like this, Andrew, any comments?
Yeah, so this is a really challenging situation of transformed myeloproliferative disease. And as the doctor mentioned, many different treatment options. What I can say is that for those patients, intensive chemotherapy, obviously the outcomes are not as good as we would like. So we're always looking for new treatment options. With respect to Ven-Aza or HMA Ven in that setting, those patients were specifically excluded from VIALE A and C. And the reason for that was particularly patients with extensive myelofibrosis, we actually saw very delayed count recovery, which might indicate that those patients have a reduced normal bone marrow reserve, which would make the toxicity issues of Ven-based approaches potentially problematic. There was also a blood advances paper from MD Anderson, first author Makarova, that used HMA-Ven in patients with transformed myeloproliferative diseases, and they found that the responses weren't particularly high and the duration of responses were particularly short. So in that setting, I don't think Ven-Aza is going to be the solution for transformed MPN. What about IDH1 inhibitors? I think this is a real possibility. The patient is in their 70s, and especially those that have comorbidities, I like the possibility of using, say, an ivosidenib with AZA for those patients with an IDH1 mutant pathology. There is actually a randomized trial that's going to be reported at ASH this year called AGILE, which compared ivosidenib plus AZA versus AZA placebo. And in fact, that study was very dramatically positive in terms of event-free survival, which was the primary endpoint of a trial, almost tripled in favor of ivo-aza 24 months versus 8 months. And furthermore, CR rates were also tripled with the combination, 47% versus 15%. And the combined response rate was 53% with ivo-aza versus 17.6% with aza. And I think that response rate of 52.8%, I think is pretty competitive with intensive chemotherapy in that patient subgroup. Obviously, we don't know whether that would translate to IDH mutant disease in the myeloproliferative transform setting, but there's no reason to suspect that that regimen would be particularly myelosuppressive because it's quite different to Ven-Aza.
We were talking before about people who are not eligible for intensive chemotherapy with FLT3 What about IDH? We know that HMA venetoclax is particularly effective in the, you know, the typical patient with AML. And also, I'm curious in terms of, is there, I always kind of viewed IDH1 and 2 as the same in terms of the disease, and enasidenib and itacitinib is kind of the same. I always try to simplify things. And then recently I heard somebody say, oh, no, they're not the same. There's maybe some differences. So first of all, IDH in the older patient, and any difference between IDH1 and 2, either disease or the inhibitors?
Yeah, so for the older patient with AML and an IDH mutation, there's a couple of things to think about. So first of all, we have now two options for IDH1 mutant disease, Ven/Aza or Aza with ivosidenib. If a patient has potentially very, very frail, for instance, I would tend to either lean towards Ivo/Aza rather than Ven/Aza, or if the patient is incredibly frail, and occasionally you get patients who are, you know, 90 plus and they're really quite frail, I would actually consider using ivosidenib or enasidenib alone as a single agent, because as a oral medication, modest to you know, very minimal toxicity, that may be the best option as opposed to palliation. In terms of, is there a difference between IDH1 and IDH2 mutant biology? Possibly there is. If you look at the co-mutation spectrum, there's different associations in terms of the partner mutations between IDH1 and IDH2, and those could have you know, important differences in terms of outcome and sensitivity to various treatments. So don't consider them to be essentially interchangeable. Furthermore, it's also important to realize that some patients who are on an IDH1 or an IDH2 inhibitor can actually have resistance through escape mutations of the other isoform. So occasionally we've seen people on an IDH1 inhibitor and then they progress with an IDH2 mutation. So again, think of these possibilities when monitoring the patient for response or resistance. And in terms of therapy, at this stage, the Ivo/Aza has been, I guess, shown to be positive in a randomized study as a primary endpoint. Enasidenib, however, in relapse refractory disease and also in frontline in combination with Aza, although it didn't show a survival benefit in the frontline setting, it did actually show an EFS benefit similar to ivosidenib.
Any comment in terms of a differentiation syndrome? When does it occur? How do you manage it? Do you hold therapy or continue?
So differentiation syndrome is still an important concern. It occurs in about 14% of patients receiving IDH inhibitors, whether it's alone or in combination with hypomethylating agents. The onset of differentiation syndrome can vary quite widely. However, one should be aware of it as early as a few weeks into treatment, but occasionally it can occur many months down the track. So vigilance and considering that possibility should always be front and center of a physician's mind. In terms of how to pick it up, that requires us to do regular blood tests. And in the first few weeks of therapy, blood tests should be done at least twice a week to pick up differentiation syndrome. And then down the track, every 2 weeks to every 4 weeks. And if a patient does have a rising white cell count, my key piece of advice is not to wait until that white cell count gets to 30, 40, or 50, but to intervene with hydroxyurea early. For instance, even if the white cell count tips over 10, if it's clearly rising, it's best to get in early, because sometimes this rising white cell count can be absolutely explosive. I've seen patients where the white cell count's gone from under 10 to over 100 within a few days. So intervening early is the key. And the second key message is, if the patient is having some symptoms, get in and use dexamethasone quickly whilst even looking for the possibility of other causes like infection. You can start the dexamethasone, do the microbiological workup, put the patient on prophylactic antibiotics if required, but don't delay the steroids if you feel the symptoms could be attributable to differentiation syndrome.
How often do you see two targetable mutations, for example, IDH and FLT3, and what do you do?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in fact, FLT3 and IDH do go together. I don't see them together that often. Of all the patients with FLT3 and IDH, it might happen in maybe about 10% of patients, but it does occur. When it does occur, the first principle of therapy, I think, is to target the mutation which is most likely to cause the most adverse outcome. And generally, that's going to be the FLT3 mutation. So if I see them together, I tend to target the FLT3 first. So for instance, if a patient is elderly, I would give either 7 and 3 with a midostaurin, or if the patient's not really fit for 7 and 3, I can also effectively use 5 and 2 with midostaurin and also get a very good result. Then if the patient has persistence of IDH mutation, we know that persistent IDH in the remission setting doesn't necessarily predict adverse prognosis. And so generally I'll reserve the IDH inhibitor until the patient has progression or failure after intensive therapy. The question about whether to use both together, I think, is an intriguing one. So we could either use ivosidenib with gilteritinib or inosidenib with gilteritinib. I believe Eton Stein is conducting that combination trial at the moment. We haven't seen any results, but I think targeting two key driver mutations within the one leukemia, I think, could be an exceptionally potent and effective approach in the future.
So I'm going to close out with a case, and I'm not sure how much there is to discuss from a scientific medical point of view, although I will be interested if you have any thoughts on this, but just more in terms of the human aspects of the situation of being the physician, being the patient's family. What a difficult situation. This is a patient of Dr. Rachel Cook, a 90-year-old man who had kept going back to his dentist with a lot of overgrowth of his gums. Finally ended up in the ER. Dr. Cook met the patient in the ER with severe neck pain, was found to have AML. Here's Dr. Cook.
90-year-old gentleman who I saw in the ER in a really difficult situation. He was having ear pain and severe neck pain. In the ER, he had a CBC done that was remarkable for a white count of 49 with 96% blasts in the peripheral blood. We got an urgent MRI, which showed a pretty significant extradural mass there that's causing severe narrowing of the spinal canal and kind of obliterating the space and causing a cord compression. He decompensated really rapidly, even over a matter of hours, with loss of strength in both arms and legs. And it's always hard when you have a 90-year-old who's got a catastrophic illness to know how to manage that in an urgent setting. We actually did have radiation oncology come in and do some urgent radiation to try to help. Fairly quick decompensation and developed quadriplegia and then transitioned to comfort care and did die in the hospital.
What are the questions you'd like to hear discussed about this case?
I haven't often called radiation oncology in the middle of the night for a leukemia patient. I thought a lot about whether it was really appropriate to put him through that in the middle of the night and if there was any meaningful expectation of recovery. So I'd be interested if other people would have managed that differently.
Any thoughts?
Yeah, one of the most challenging situations. With respect to CNS pathology and leukemia, I usually categorize such patients into three different groups. Those with leptomeningeal disease, those with cranial nerve pathology, and third, those with sarcomas, as in this situation, causing cord compression. With leptomeningeal disease, an intrathecal chemotherapy is appropriate. For cranial nerve disease, high-dose ARA-C would be the best option. However, obviously, you can't do that in someone who's 90. For sarcomas, then usually radiation is an appropriate option as used by Dr. Cook. Craniospinal irradiation to shrink the lesion and then followed with effective therapy is usually the option. If it's a younger patient, high-dose ARA-C is usually the way to go. However, in a 90-year-old, what will we do in the absence of strong evidence? There is some intriguing case reports that, in fact, venetoclax does penetrate into the CSF to some extent, about 0.3% of the plasma concentration, which as a free drug level can actually be anti-leukemic. And there was a case report showing venetoclax given systemically to benefit a patient with CNS disease. So in this particular case, either using Ven/Aza after the radiation as consolidation therapy, if one wanted to use it up front and not go to radiotherapy, then because the white cell count was quite high, I would be concerned about tumor lysis syndrome. So what I would do is give the patient a few sequential doses of just stat-ara-C, maybe 100 to 200 milligrams, get that white cell count down to below 20, 25, and then potentially start venaza plus or minus supplemental radiotherapy. That could all still be futile in these really elderly and difficult patients. And sometimes supportive care with just dexamethasone may also be the right option. So again, talk to the patient, understand their needs and goals, and obviously select the best treatment option, but realizing that it's a complicated scenario, whatever we do.